File 56.
This situation offered a good opportunity of studying the miserable cowardliness of our so-called intellectuals, who shirked the duty of offering serious resistance to the poisoning of the sound instincts of our people. They left it to the people themselves to formulate their own attitude towards this impudent nonsense, lest they might be considered as understanding nothing of art. They accepted every caricature of art, until they finally lost the power of judging what is really good or bad. Taken all in all, there were superabundant symptoms to show that a diseased epoch had begun. Still another critical symptom has to be considered. In the course of the 19th century, our towns and cities began more and more to lose their character as centres of civilization and become more and more centres of habitation. In our great modern cities, the proletariat does not show much attachment to the place where it lives. This feeling results from the fact that their dwelling place is nothing but an accidental abode, and that feeling is also partly due to the frequent change of residence which is forced upon them by social conditions. There is no time for the growth of any attachment to the town in which they live. But another reason lies in the cultural barrenness and superficiality of our modern cities. At the time of the German Wars of Liberation, our German towns and cities were not only small in number, but also very modest in size. The few that could really be called great cities were mostly the residential cities of princes. As such, they had almost always a definite cultural value, and also a definite cultural aspect. Those few towns which had more than 50,000 inhabitants were, in comparison with modern cities of the same size, rich in scientific and artistic treasures. At the time when Munich had not more than 60,000 souls, it was already well on the way to becoming one of the first German centres of art. Nowadays, almost every industrial town has a population at least as large as that, without having anything of real value to call its own. They are agglomerations of tenement houses and congested dwelling barracks, and nothing else. It would be a miracle if anybody should grow sentimentally attached to such a meaningless place. Nobody can grow attached to a place which offers only just as much or as little as any other place would offer, which has no character of its own, and where obviously pains have been taken to avoid everything that might have any resemblance to an artistic appearance. But this is not all. Even the great cities become more barren of real works of art the more they increase in population. They assume more and more a neutral atmosphere and present the same aspect, though on a larger scale, as the wretched little factory towns. Everything that our modern age has contributed to the civilization of our great cities is absolutely deficient. All our towns are living on the glory and the treasures of the past. If we take away from the Munich of today everything that was created under Ludwig II, we should be horror-stricken to see how meagre has been the output of important artistic creations since that time. One might say much the same of Berlin and most of our other great towns. But the following is the essential thing to be noticed. Our great modern cities have no outstanding monuments that dominate the general aspect of the city and could be pointed to as the symbols of a whole epoch. Yet almost every ancient town had a monument erected to its glory. It was not in private dwellings that the characteristic art of ancient cities was displayed, but in the public monuments, which were not meant to have a transitory interest, but an enduring one. And this was because they did not represent the wealth of some individual citizen, but the greatness and importance of the community. It was under this inspiration that those monuments arose, which bound the individual inhabitants to their own town in a manner that is often almost incomprehensible to us today. What struck the eye of the individual citizen was not a number of mediocre private buildings, but imposing structures that belonged to the whole community. In contradistinction to these, private dwellings were of only very secondary importance indeed. When we compare the size of those ancient public buildings with that of the private dwellings belonging to the same epoch, then we can understand the great importance which was given to the principle that those works which reflected and affected the life of the community should take precedence of all others. Among the broken arches and vast spaces that are covered with ruins from the ancient world, the colossal riches that still arouse our wonder have not been left to us from the commercial palaces of these days, but from the temples of the gods and the public edifices that belonged to the state. The community itself was the owner of these great edifices. Even in the pomp of Rome during the decadence, it was not the villas and palaces of some citizens that filled the most prominent place, but rather the temples and the baths, the stadia, the circuses, the aqueducts, the basilicas, etc., which belonged to the state, and therefore to the people as a whole. In medieval Germany also the same principle held sway, although the artistic outlook was quite different. In ancient times, the theme that found its expression in the Acropolis or the Pantheon was now clothed in the forms of the Gothic cathedral. In the medieval cities, these monumental structures towered gigantically above the swarm of smaller buildings with their framework walls of wood and brick, and they remain the dominant feature of these cities even to our own day, although they are becoming more and more obscured by the apartment barracks. They determine the character and appearance of the locality. Cathedrals, city halls, corn exchanges, defense towers are the outward expression of an idea which has its counterpart only in the ancient world. The dimensions and quality of our public buildings today are in deplorable contrast to the edifices that represent private interests. If a similar fate should befall Berlin as befell Rome, future generations might gaze upon the ruins of some Jewish department stores or joint stock hotels and think that these were the characteristic expressions of the culture of our time. In Berlin itself, compare the shameful disproportion between the buildings which belong to the Reich and those which have been erected for the accommodation of trade and finance. The credits that are voted for public buildings are in most cases inadequate and really ridiculous. They are not built as structures that were meant to last, but mostly for the purpose of answering the need of the moment. No higher idea influenced those who commissioned such buildings. At the time the Berlin Schloss was built, it had a quite different significance from what the new library has for our time, seeing that one battleship alone represents an expenditure of about 60 million marks, whereas less than half that sum was allotted for the building of the Reichstag, which is the most imposing structure erected for the Reich, and which should have been built to last for ages. Yet, in deciding the question of internal decoration, the upper house voted against the use of stone and ordered that the walls should be covered with stucco. For once, however, the parliamentarians made an appropriate decision on that occasion, for plaster heads would be out of place between stone walls. The community as such is not the dominant characteristic of our contemporary cities, and therefore it is not to be wondered at if the community does not find itself architecturally represented. Thus we must eventually arrive at a veritable civic desert, which will at last be reflected in the total indifference of the individual citizen towards his own country. This is also a sign of a cultural decay, a general breakup. Our era is entirely preoccupied with little things which are to no purpose, or rather it is entirely preoccupied in the service of money. Therefore it is not to be wondered at if, with the worship of such an idol, the sense of heroism should entirely disappear. But the present is only reaping what the past has sown. All these symptoms which preceded the final collapse of the Second Empire must be attributed to the lack of a definite and uniformly accepted Weltanschauung and the general uncertainty of outlook consequent on that lack. This uncertainty showed itself when the great questions of the time had to be considered one after another, and a decisive policy adopted towards them. This lack is also accountable for the habit of doing everything by halves, beginning with the educational system, the shilly-shally, the reluctance to undertake responsibilities, and finally, the cowardly tolerance of evils that were even admitted to be destructive. Visionary humanitarianism became the fashion. In weakly submitting to these aberrations and sparing the feelings of the individual, the future of millions of human beings was sacrificed. An examination of the religious situation before the war shows that the general process of disruption had extended to this sphere also. A great part of the nation itself had for a long time already ceased to have any convictions of a uniform and practical character in their ideological outlook on life. In this matter, the point of primary importance was by no means the number of people who renounced their church membership, but rather the widespread indifference. While the two Christian denominations maintained missions in Asia and Africa, for the purpose of securing new adherents to the faith, these same denominations were losing millions and millions of their adherents at home, in Europe. These former adherents either gave up religion wholly as a directive force in their lives, or they adopted their own interpretation of it. The consequences of this were specially felt in the moral life of the country. In parenthesis, it may be remarked that the progress made by the missions in spreading the Christian faith abroad was only quite modest in comparison with the spread of Mohammedanism. It must be noted, too, that the attack on the dogmatic principles underlying ecclesiastical teaching increased steadily in violence, and yet this human world of ours would be inconceivable without the practical existence of a religious belief. The great masses of a nation are not composed of philosophers. For the masses of the people especially, faith is absolutely the only basis of a moral outlook on life. The various substitutes that have been offered have not shown any results that might warrant us in thinking that they might usefully replace the existing denominations. But if religious teaching and religious faith were once accepted by the broad masses as active forces in their lives, then the absolute authority of the doctrines of faith would be the foundation of all practical effort. There may be a few hundreds of thousands of superior men who can live wisely and intelligently without depending on the general standards that prevail in everyday life, but the millions of others cannot do so. Now the place which general custom fills in everyday life corresponds to that of general laws in the state and dogma in religion. The purely spiritual idea is of itself a changeable thing that may be subjected to endless interpretations. It is only through dogma that it is given a precise and concrete form without which it could not become a living faith. Otherwise, the spiritual idea would never become anything more than a mere metaphysical concept, or rather, a philosophical opinion. Accordingly, the attack against dogma is comparable to an attack against the general laws on which the state is founded, and so this attack would finally lead to complete political anarchy if it were successful, just as the attack on religion would lead to a worthless religious nihilism. The political leader should not estimate the worth of a religion by taking some of its shortcomings into account, but he should ask himself whether there be any practical substitute in a view which is demonstrably better. Until such a substitute be available, only fools and criminals would think of abolishing the existing religion. Undoubtedly, no small amount of blame for the present unsatisfactory religious situation must be attributed to those who have encumbered the ideal of religion with purely material accessories, and have thus given rise to an utterly futile conflict between religion and science. In this conflict, victory will very nearly always be on the side of science. Even though, after a bitter struggle, while religion will suffer heavily in the eyes of those who cannot penetrate beneath the mere superficial aspects of science. But the greatest damage of all has come from the practice of debasing religion as a means that can be exploited to serve political interests, or rather, commercial interests. The impudent and loud-mouthed liars who do this make their profession of faith before the whole world in stentorian tones so that all poor mortals may hear. Not that they are ready to die for it if necessary, but rather that they may live all the better. They are ready to sell their faith for any political quid pro quo. For 10 parliamentary mandates, they would ally themselves with the Marxists, who are the mortal foes of all religion. And for a seat in the cabinet, they would go the length of wedlock with the devil, if the latter had still not retained some traces of decency.